In the coming week, the 75th UN General Assembly kicks off. President Lukashenko of Belarus is set to meet with President Putin in Moscow, and a virtual China-EU summit is set to take place. It's September 10th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's kick off the show by talking about the United Nations General Assembly. Each year, UNGA, as it's called, has a new session. Historically, these sessions are held at the UN's headquarters in New York. This year's UNGA session is going to be virtual because of COVID-19, so it's going to have a very different look and feel than years past. So, Bob, can you give us a sense of how UNGA is going to unfold here in 2020 and whether there is a theme organizing this year's session?
Sure, Jim. First of all, there's always a theme, and the theme presents itself in the very setting that you described. So a backdrop to everything is going to be, I think, how the world should be responding to the COVID pandemic. But first, it's a birthday. It's this big round birthday, 75 years of UN. That was supposed to be a part of a big deal. Birthday parties are much better when everybody's allowed, able to come in person. I don't know about you, but in my family, most of the birthdays have been celebrated recently through Zoom calls with extended family members.
Been there, done that.
Yep. And the UN's going to do the same thing, although it's not going to be so much about, you know, the cake and candles as it is about a collective sense of global responsibility. So first of all, it's the birthday, but it's also a theme, which one would think is a theme every year, of multilateralism. This year, the title is The Future We Want, The UN We Need, Reaffirming Our Collective Commitment to Multilateralism. So that's a weighty set of issues to think about. It's also interesting to note, CFR President Richard Haass has a new piece out in Project Syndicate where he talks about how the UN is essentially become the UN that the major powers want, but not the UN that they need. So he's done a little riff on that. And I think what he's getting to, and what a lot of people when they talk about the UN these days are getting to, are the problems that have evolved in the UN Security Council, the chamber that is most, let's say, most potent, most relevant, most powerful in the UN. And when it's working together, and most powerful in the world at being able to sway global events. It is in a dysfunctional period at the moment, in great part because the big powers are at cross purposes in a number of areas. You just have to start with the coronavirus, where it's essentially been ineffectual, the UN Security Council. That's not to say UN agencies have been ineffectual. The UN is, in addition to the Security Council, a whole number of agencies involved in humanitarian and other issues. I should also mention, Jim, that the lead UN health agency, the WHO, is itself facing a bit of controversy over the way it has handled certainly the immediate outbreak of the coronavirus, the way it seemed to be under China's sway, and how it seemed to have antagonize the U.S., which has announced it's pulling out of the WHO. So a whole bunch of themes that seem to be at cross purposes with multilateralism as the UN General Assembly gets underway. I should also note, Jim, that the big debate that everybody's accustomed to in September is the week after next. Next week formally opens the session. There are some opening speeches and sessions going on virtually. It is the following week where you have world leaders weighing in at the great debate that will be interesting to watch. And a final point on that is, in many years, because certain leaders can't or rarely make the trip in person to New York, you tend to have a set of some leaders, and then you have foreign ministers and other ministers taking your place. This year, you have the capability of every major leader appearing because they can just sit in their office in whatever country they're in and address the UN. That is going to be very interesting.
Bob, do we have any sense of how these world leaders are going to handle speaking at the UN virtually? Again, you sort of think of classic UN General Assembly meetings. A leader gets up and makes a speech and the camera pans to the crowd. You can see other leaders sitting there stone-faced or clapping and applauding.
Or in some cases, walking out even.
Or walking out. But you're not going to have that dynamic. Any sense of how leaders are going to handle sort of the virtual speech? Because they're just talking into a computer or a TV camera, and there's no guarantee that the people they're trying to reach are even listening.
The latest I've seen in terms of the way they're going to approach this is that the world leaders and government leaders are going to be submitting video statements that will be played in the General Assembly Hall. It's not necessarily, though, that it's something where at that very moment, wherever they are, whatever time it is, wherever they are, will they suddenly be appearing live on Zoom. It's more like, here's the statement that they've taped to be played in succession in the General Assembly Hall. But to your point about the atmospherics, who are they playing to in the hall? There would be some small sort of skeleton crew of people who or having been duly tested and socially distanced will be in the hall. But it's really about, I think, the world seeing this succession of faces of leaders making their statements about the state of the world, the state of their country's role in the world, or their vision for the world. Again, all new territory. It's going to be very interesting to see how much of them stick to the script and also how long the script is. The UN General Assembly is famous for leaders going on and on and speaking well beyond the allotted time that they're all supposed to be speaking for. So we could be seeing maybe a few terse statements, but possibly some very long ones.
But Bob, how do you expect journalists to cover what essentially are going to be canned speeches? I mean, the great thing about being in the hall is you can write about how it was received and you can give it a lot of play, but you're not going to have that. So it's not clear to me whether these speeches are going to get picked up by anybody's media, certainly not to the extent they have in the past, which then raises the question of whether the session is going to have any impact at all.
No, it's a good point. I mean, as someone who used to cover these speeches, that was part of the interest. I mean, sometimes you'd get the speech, you know, within a few minutes of the actual address, and so have a chance to kind of pick through it and prepare, you know, circle things you thought were important, whatever. Sometimes you didn't see anything or hear anything until the leader was speaking, which made it, you know, very of the moment. One could imagine, since if these things are prepared in advance, possibly well in advance, you could have some leaked aspects to these speeches coming out so that it'll be truly anticlimactic when the time they speak. Maybe they'll be under closer wraps. I don't know. But again, it is seeming to steal the thunder of what has been the signal moment of these meetings, especially the first couple of days where you tend to have, first of all, the U.S. president speaks the morning of the first day. You tend to have other world leaders and other Security Council leaders speaking around that time. And, you know, day one, two, and three are when all the drama is for the most part. But then there's all sorts of sideline meetings. So here's again, the in-person aspect, Jim, is a good deal of business gets done in various corridors at the U.N. or in the case of the U.S., which has had a permanent chamber at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, you know, business over there or wherever hotel the U.S. is putting the president in. All that dynamic is gone. And so it's like a lot of the other virtual meetings that we've seen taking place. It's lacking quite a bit. And business does get done to some extent, but it's going to be a very muted affair, I think, for the 75th UN birthday.
Bob, that's a real good point that what we're not going to see at the 75th UNGA are these bilats, these meetings on the sideline of the main show where a lot of diplomacy gets done. I'm going to be very curious, you know, a number of years from now, seeing how people write about how diplomacy was affected by COVID-19. I mean, if you think of someone like George H.W. Bush, who put a great deal of stock in his diplomacy and personal relationships, had built them up over time, wanted to meet with people, wanted to hear from them, solicited their view. And that was a big part of his diplomacy. But now you're in a world in which, at least for the time being, you're not going to be in the same room as the other leader to size him or her up, to build that bond. And again, think of how many leaders have gone out of their way during the Trump presidency to try to establish, like Shinzo Abe did, that personal rapport with the president to try to make your country's diplomacy work. It's very interesting to see what's going to happen in this world where you're reduced to phone calls or to Zoom calls or whatever other ways there are to broadcast digitally.
Yeah. And again, there couldn't be more pressing business to be dealt with at the moment. Obviously, front and center, the pandemic and coordinating a global response to everything from vaccine development to possibly, you know, a coordinated testing regimen and getting the world economy moving again. The UN is going to try valiantly to raise the objectives of the Sustainable Development Goals, which they actually had been making some progress on in certain areas, especially like in poverty reduction. Now they're looking at poverty backsliding for the first time, like 20 years by the tens of millions, in great part because of the pandemic. So there's a lot of important business that has to be done. It's going to be really taxing, not only the leaders, but their entourages, the various foreign ministries that are charged with a lot of business there and development ministries. You know, as you say, Jim, years from now, we're going to be looking back on this and saying, what was that? Or boy, was that a struggle or something like that? Jim, I want to turn our attention to what's going on and continues to go on in Belarus. Here we are several weeks now after the elections, the flawed elections in the country in which the president, Alexander Lukashenko, claimed more than 80% of the vote. And the Belarusian people, despite huge crackdown, imprisonment, intimidation, the fleeing of many of their leaders in the opposition, have continued to turn out in great numbers. And it's raising a great deal of questions about just what is the future here? What is the future for the the Lukashenko regime? What is the state of unity in the opposition? What is the role of Russia? It looks like there's going to be a trip to Russia by President Lukashenko in the coming week. Do we have any sense, Jim, of what the two leaders are going to talk about either on this trip or maybe they've already been talking about?
Well, Bob, I think there's a big question here, whether or not this trip is going to come off. I should stress there's been speculation or a rumor that President Lukashenko is going to head off to Moscow on Monday, September 14th to meet with Vladimir Putin, but that hasn't been confirmed in any way. In all of these discussions, there are really two big unknowns that people should focus on. The first is probably the more obvious one, and that is whether or not Lukashenko is confident that he can leave Belarus and be allowed to return. As you point out, the protests have been quite strong. They are happening each and every day, but they have really surged on the weekends. People are not working so they can turn out. It's been mostly a city phenomenon, but not solely a city phenomenon. And again, Lukashenko may make a decision over this coming weekend that conditions aren't good to actually leave the country. But the second consideration going on here is, what is Vladimir Putin seeking to do? Now, what's his objective? Is he looking to get closer to Lukashenko? Or does he see Lukashenko is someone who has been irreparably harmed, and it doesn't serve Russian interests to get closer to? And again, one of the calculations Putin has to make, or one of the facts he's aware of, is that the protests in Belarus to this point have essentially not been anti-Russian. It's very different than what we saw in Ukraine back in 2014.
Extremely different. Really good point. Right? Yeah.
I mean, a lot of Ukrainians sort of felt that, you know, Russia was too prominent in their lives. They wanted distance from Russia. They wanted to join the West. That's not what we're seeing in the Belarus protests. And so it's not clear that Putin is considering sort of taking a page out of the Ukraine playbook and repeating it here in Belarus. He certainly could, but that doesn't look to be his main play. The idea of introducing little green men or sort of annexing part of the country as he did in Ukraine with the annexation of Crimea. What we may be seeing here in the Belarus case is something fundamentally different, is whether Putin has calculated the time has come for him to undertake what might be called a soft annexation of all of Belarus. Now, to understand how that might play out, you got to go back and understand that about a quarter century ago, Russia and Belarus signed the so-called Union State Agreement, which envisioned this really tight integration of Russia and Belarus economically and politically. That document was signed in 1996. Boris Yeltsin was the Russian president at the time, but it's largely been meaningless.
Lukashenko had been in power for maybe a couple of years at that point, right?
Correct. He had just been in for a while, and there was a lot of talk about how close the two are going to come together, but it never really happened. And indeed, Lukashenko in recent years has been sort of trying to distance himself from Moscow. So what happens now is that Putin has a legitimate formal structure that he can play to and say that he is simply carrying out what the Belarusians and the Russians agreed to long ago. And we've seen a lot of talk, for example, that the Russians are beginning to sort of penetrate the Belarusian state, take over some of its apparatus. This has been seen most clearly when we talk about the state news media in Belarus. When the protests erupted, a lot of people who worked in Belarus TV walked off their sets. What happened? The Russians flew in their own people to take over and run the TV shows. Indeed, some of them, as I understand it, ran TV shows with still using the emblems from their home Russian networks. So there is this idea that rather than nibbling at parts of Belarus, we may see it devoured as a whole. That creates real challenges for the West, because we were talking about the European Union, we're talking about the United States. What they don't want to do is to take steps that are going to make it easier for or provoke Putin into going down this road and sort of holding up the Union State model and saying he is simply just carrying out the terms and agreement that Moscow and Belarus have struck a number of years ago. And again, for the protesters, again, to this point, they haven't been anti-Russian. They haven't been saying we want to join the West. They've mostly been saying we want to have a clean, effective government and just let us govern ourselves, and which is why you're not hearing a lot of Belarusians calling on the West to impose sanctions, because it would both delegitimate their nationalist claims and also create a situation to potentially, if they're broad-based sanctions, of inflicting harm on their fellow citizens. And so this is a very tough diplomatic situation.
Just to play into that a little bit more, Jim, then. So what do you think are the options in countries in, you know, the European Union? We've seen certainly some vigorous support for the opposition in some of the Baltic countries, maybe exceptionally so, but a little bit more guarded response in some of the Western European powers. So what are the levers they have at this point in a country like Belarus?
Well, they don't have much in the way of leverage. That's part of the problem. I mean, they certainly can impose pain on Russia. And to some extent, that has been the approach the Trump administration has taken. My understanding is that Steve Biegun, who's Deputy Secretary of State, told his Russian counterpart, you know, U.S.-Russia relations right now aren't good, but if we see something like Ukraine repeated in Belarus, U.S.-Russian relations could still get a lot worse. Of course, it's a bigger challenge, as I said, if we don't have that kind of nibbling away at sovereignty or, you know, resorting to the so-called little green men, but rather you have the Russians simply moving forward with the cooperation of elements within Belarus of fulfilling the vision of the Union State. That's why I think this has been a real challenge and why the EU, which has gone with some targeted sanctions that have been mostly symbolic, because what the European Union doesn't want to do is to make it easier for Putin to go ahead. And I think this is sort of the delicate dance. But again, it all comes back to what does Putin judge his interest to be in Belarus? What is his best play? And I don't think we have a real good sense of that.
I'll just note for those interested in learning more on this crisis, you had a fascinating discussion on sister podcast, President's Inbox, this week, Jim, with our colleague Steve Sestanovich. So I recommend people give a listen to that as well.
Thanks for the plug, Bob. But let's shift gears and talk about a highly anticipated summit that is going to take place involving China in the European Union, set to occur in Leipzig, Germany. Now, this is a scale-back summit. It's going to be led by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, as Germany is currently the president of the Council of the European Union. So set the scene for us, Bob. What do you think Chancellor Merkel wants to achieve during this meeting with President Xi and other EU leaders?
Yeah, it's very much an EU-China gathering, although it's safe to say Chancellor Merkel will try to make some points on Germany's behalf as well. But I would start with this being very much an EU vis-a-vis China meeting. You're going to have the European Commission president also attending, Ursula von der Leyen, who's a German national. You're going to have European Council president Charles Michel attending as well. And again, attending, this is a virtual meeting, and they'll be, to the extent they can get into the issues in any detail, it is limited a bit by this kind of removed setting. So they already come into this knowing it's going to be a bit scaled back. But there's a lot at stake here, too. There's a great many issues. We touched on it briefly in our previous podcast a couple weeks ago when we talked about Taiwan, Jim. There's a number of issues that the Europeans and the Chinese need to sort out. Trade is first and foremost an issue that this summit is going to be focusing on, especially trying to get through the thorny issues that are continuing to confront and disrupt an investment agreement between the European Union and China. The Europeans, like the U.S., have a number of issues about the way China subsidizes its major industries, the way it limits outside parties from doing business in China while it enjoys its own ability to do business in other countries. Just one case in point, European lawyers are not able to open a law firm in China, but a Chinese lawyer can do so in Europe, according to EU officials. China has very strict internet controls that have put a crimp on being able to do business. There are two major European players in 5G, Ericsson and Nokia, that have a fraction of the of business in China versus Huawei, which has a large chunk of business in EU countries. So there are issues like that at stake and sort of getting over those. The Europeans are looking for some sort of concrete commitments on the part of China to credibly open up their country for business and then, you know, hopefully level the playing field and they can go from there. There's a lot of intrigue involved in this summit as well because it's coming less than 2 months before the U.S. elections. If there is a change in leadership in the U.S., you could have a different approach from Joe Biden vis-a-vis Europe, for example, maybe becomes an opening and a softening in EU-US trade ties versus the approach that Donald Trump has taken, where he's sort of in all directions, he's sent out a tough message on U.S. trade and his willingness to use tariffs. So there's all sorts of things percolating as this meeting unfolds, Jim. And you have within the EU a bit of dissension, shall we say, on some of Chinese inroads, such as the Belt and Road, where some countries have been eager to kind of sign up Chinese businesses as part of that process. Others are more concerned about it.
Bob, any sense that EU leaders are going to talk about Hong Kong? The new Beijing-imposed national security law clearly breaks with the terms of the agreement for the handover of Hong Kong. It's a departure in international law. EU prides itself championing international law. Are we going to hear about that? Also, are we going to hear anything about the confrontation now taking place in the Himalayas between the Indians and the Chinese? It appears that the Chinese have initiated the clashes there.
The latest I saw on that is that they're trying to dial down the tensions, the Indians and the Chinese. But certainly that's something that I think one would expect it to be raised. There have already been signals that the issue of a number of Chinese, let's say, human rights violations and security moves are going to be raised by the EU side. The Uyghur issue, it sounds like it's going to be raised as well. There's been an increasing number of reports about what China has done to suppress and repress the Uyghur population, the Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Hong Kong, obviously, for the reasons you raised, Jim, doesn't sit well among a number of EU countries about its role there. The Chinese traveling officials just a couple of weeks ago got an earful, especially in Germany and in France, about the comments towards the Czech Republic, which was making warm overtures towards Taiwan. So it's this this real divide in terms of values and in terms of being able to carry any sort of human rights dialogue is going to be also fascinating to watch. The Chinese essentially don't like to carry on a dialogue on human rights as it pertains to their own country. They call it an internal affair. They consistently have done so. But if it becomes something that's a sticking point in a crucial relationship, and China needs this relationship as well, this has become a very lucrative trade relationship both ways. It's going to be very interesting to see how they try to deal with it, whether they want to just sort of strong arm it as they have most recently, or whether they're going to be more accommodating.
It'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. I suspect that the public aspects of the summit meeting are going to play down the differences on those security issues.
Yeah, I think that's what people should suspect. I think if you had an in-person meeting, there's always a chance that some of these things could be raised in a different way, at the very least at any sort of joint media appearance or things like that. So those things seem to be much more muted affairs when they're done virtually. And so summits become much more behind closed doors. Jim, we've reached our figure of the week part of the podcast. So who or what is your figure?
Bob, I am going with a person as my figure of the week, and it's Mulan, or if you prefer, the Disney executives who greenlighted the new live-action movie. It was released on Disney Plus over the weekend, and it has stirred up a new round of criticism that touches on some of the issues we were just discussing. Now, you might recall that Mulan was supposed to be released earlier in the year. It was held up by COVID-19. Movie theaters got shut down. Again, it's skipping movie theaters and going on to the Disney Plus channel. But even last fall, the movie was coming under fire because the Chinese actress who plays Mulan in the movie tweeted out her endorsement of the Hong Kong police, who at the time were cracking down on pro-democracy demonstrators. But now that the movie has been released, what people notice as they watch the credits is that the movie was filmed in part in Xinjiang, precisely the place you were talking about, where the Uyghurs are being repressed and being held in mass internment camps. And once that happened, the social media machine cranked up, people noting that Disney thanked 8 government entities in Xinjiang. One of those entities mentioned was a police bureau in the city of Turpin, which is on the old Silk Road. And I should note that last year, the Trump administration put that police bureau on a blacklist that forbids U.S. companies to sell or supply products to them. And that has touched off a series of criticism for American politicians and activists on a human rights front. It also raises the broader question of what responsibilities companies like Disney have to take into account the behavior of the governments that they do business with. And it really is put in stark relief in the case of China because of the size of its market. American companies want to sell into that market. Again, think if you're a movie company, you want to be able to sell, have your movies be seen in a country of 1.3 billion people. It's not that hard to understand the logic there. Now, I don't know, not being a lawyer, whether Disney violated any of the sanctions. I suspect not. But clearly, many people in its American audience and Western audience are going to frown upon what has happened here because it seems to be just ignoring China's outrageous and horrific treatment of the Uyghurs. So on the one hand, you have this big question of Are we going to be in the case in a free, democratic, capitalist society, companies going off and cooperating with, maybe even directly or indirectly enabling the repression of others? Or should they somehow be restricted from doing so? And it's also a real interesting question here of whether this boycott can work in any meaningful way. And I mean, is it going to get the Chinese to change its behavior? All signs are that the Chinese just don't listen to any criticism from outside their borders, and particularly public criticism, but rather, as you point out, their attitude is to turn around and try to apply pressure, target, ostracize people who are criticizing it. There's also real concern in this specific case that a boycott isn't likely to be effective because people's viewing of Mulan is going to be taking place in private. No one's really sure what you're streaming. It's very different from being seen walking into your local Cineplex, buying a ticket to see Mulan. So it'll be very interesting to see where this goes forward. But again, it touches on this bigger issue of the nature relationship of American Western corporations in China, where clearly the West and Western values are at odds with what the Chinese government is seeking to do.
Yeah, and you raised a lot of important points there, Jim. I think some of the reporting I've seen in related to the Mulan movie making and those statements of thanks to officials who were involved in Xinjiang, they note that there has been almost a 20-year period in which you've now had a number of movies coming out of Hollywood that if China is involved in any capacity, any sort of, let's say, controversial or critical views of China are muted or left out. This becomes an important point and especially as we continue to see the way the world responds to the Uyghur crackdown, that we continue to see what the Chinese do, if anything, to end that crackdown, as well as what they're doing in Hong Kong, as well as what they may do vis-a-vis Taiwan, their actions on the Indian border, you name it. What is the world preparing to do? What are giant corporations like Disney prepared to do to change the way they do business with China? As I'm thinking of any other precedents, it's quite a different set of circumstances than we faced with, say, the Sullivan principles in South Africa, where you had a country that, while it had a great deal of lucrative trade arrangements that were affected by countries curtailing business, still nothing on the scale of China.
Yeah, certainly. And that's what changes the whole conversation. You really run a risk of self-censorship. I would have to imagine in Hollywood today, if you were pitching a movie in which the villain is a Chinese national, you're probably not going to get a great hearing because people are going to be saying, yeah, that's going to basically lock us out of the China market. It's the biggest market in the world. It's that sort of self-censorship issue, which isn't just involving Hollywood. We've seen these issues raised in terms of news coverage and who's allowed into the country and what terms they have to abide by. I think this is going to be a big issue that's going to continue to bubble along. And to go back to a point you made earlier about the lack of reciprocity, historically, the Chinese have not faced similar constraints on what they do and how they operate in Western societies. I think this gets us into that bigger conversation about decoupling. It's probably inevitable, but how is it going to proceed? Can it be managed well or not? And are there steps you can take or ways to take steps to get China to change its behavior? It's a big issue for this administration, Europeans, and a variety of others. But who or what, Bob, is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number. I'm going to take us in a different direction with the number 13.
Well, that's bad luck.
It's bad luck, but it's a number that's got a number of museum and archaeologists experts mesmerized right now, because just this past week, the announcement came from the Egyptian Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities on Facebook that they had found 13 ancient Egyptian coffins, 2,500 years old, piled on top of one another in perfect shape by all appearances. So well preserved that you could see the intricate designs on them, which were in blue, gold, white, black, and red, still visible. They were discovered in a huge, what they called necropolis, a burial area in the desert of the town of Saqqara. This is part of a complex that is still being excavated, and they're still finding all sorts of incredibly rich finds here. But it basically was part of the ancient capital of Egypt in Memphis, and dating from a period, according to a number of reports I've read, during which Egypt was actually under the sway of the Persian Empire, but still a period in which there were all sorts of rich to, say, well-to-do Egyptians being buried with their worldly possessions, offering incredible insight into the state of society, the hierarchy, and so forth. They haven't opened these. They are taking this, you know, one step at a time, but I think there's a great deal of interest in what they encounter. And as all these cases with these mummies, sometimes they're so well-preserved, they're able to sort of make assumptions about, you know, even eating habits during this time period. So for anybody with interest in this time period, it was a fascinating week amidst the turmoil in the news cycle from elsewhere.
I'm glad you flagged this story. It's a terrific story, Bob, but I have to tell you, it leaves me with a touch of sadness because my plan for later this year was to take a couple of weeks off to actually go visit Egypt and see the antiquities. And I'm reminded now that that's not in the cards. But I guess I can see it on Zoom.
There's a lot to explore digitally, Jim. It's nowhere near the same thing. And hopefully you can revive that trip in the not so distant future. But yes, you can explore. And this comes on the top of other finds made in the same necropolis that, you know, have people's heads spinning. So it's a good time to beef up further on your Egyptology, Jim, so that you are well equipped to check out some of these sites when you do go.
Sounds good, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The 9/11 terrorist attacks are remembered in the United States, and the election for the president of the Inter-American Development Bank is scheduled to go forward.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlin. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Zoe Collins did double duty as a recording engineer this week. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and stay healthy out there.